Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
What a lovely day!
In a world where action movies are constantly exploding at the box office, our heroes take on the monumental task of dissecting and analyzing all aspects of action movies to truly understand what it takes to make a great action film. Ben Bateman, Andrew Guy, in a Popcorn Talk Network exclusive, this is Action Movie Anatomy.
What's up, everybody? How y'all doing? I'm Ben Bateman. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy on the Popcorn Talk Network, your official network for movies and all things movie related. I'm joined today by my co-host, Andrew Guy.
What's up? I can hardly stay seated right now.
And Steph Z.
Hey guys, how's it going? So excited to be here with you guys.
Yeah, this is really an exciting day today. We recap action movies on this show, as you guys know. They have to adhere to four basic rules. Rule number one, they are made after 1981. That's like the baseline rule. But rule number one is, the hero always plays by their own rules. Rule number two, at least one explosion. Rule number three, the hero and the villain are always the smartest guys in the room. And rule number four, the movie is driven by a police, military, or political figure. Now, sometimes we defy the rules just a little bit. We kind of go outside of those rules a little. This one sort of loosely pertains to it. We are doing Mad Max Fury Road today. So that's really exciting. I'm just going to go on record and say totally awesome.
Oh, God, this movie blew me away. I felt like I was a child again watching it.
It was amazing.
It did. It kind of exceeded all my expectations, I'm not going to lie.
Now, we have deeper thoughts, of course. And the first thing I want to say is, guys, this is going to be an episode with spoilers. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, stop watching this right now. Pause it. Go watch it and come right back because we are going to give everything away. If you have seen it, stick around and let's get right into it. The first thing we're going to do is we are going to watch the trailer for you guys. The trailer basically is the movie because it doesn't give away the plot, but we'll get into that. It looks like the movie, and that's what you're doing, is you're just going to see the movie to look at it. So, let's watch the trailer.
Very eloquently stated.
Yeah. I'm a Rhodes Scholar, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
From both the living.
I just get so excited when Tom Hardy talks.
A man reduced to a single instinct.
It's nice to hear Muse's accent, like his near proper accent.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
He's such a badass.
Oh, he is. I have a total man crush on him.
I think the world does right now.
I think so.
Yeah, how could you not?
Yeah.
From the ashes.
He seems like he's like kind of really hit his stride.
I don't know about it. He kind of hits his stride in the trailer, but...
What? I just mean in his career.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, since the first time I saw him in Inception, that was like the first, like I'd seen Bronson, but he didn't kind of like think of who he was then.
Right.
But when I saw Inception, I was like, dude, this guy is a badass. I want to see everything this guy does. And then it just got better and
What's the Black Hawk Down? That's the one that he shows up in from a long time ago.
Right. Yeah. And you don't even think about that.
So he's been at it for a while.
Yeah.
What a lovely day!
I mean, the costumes, makeup.
Oh, the cinematography, the set design, like...
Amazing.
It's just... I love that he's got a little Bane mask on for part of the movie.
Yeah.
Sweet.
That's awesome.
That's what I needed.
So insane.
Whoa.
If you guys haven't watched the whole 20-minute behind-the-scenes, it's not even like a behind-the-scenes special, it's just 20 minutes of behind-the-scenes footage.
Uh-huh. Right.
I pulled a couple clips for later, but... It's insane. It's total insanity.
As the world fell,
it's just like handheld cams and just cars exploding in the desert.
Right.
It's so bananas.
I'm surprised they didn't use like GoPros and stuff for this as well. Motocross jumping over and stuff like that. That would have been. I mean, they showed some of those scenes, and I think. I wonder if they used any drones. I mean, I'm sure they did for some.
CL outfitted his camera crew with like 12 crash cams, all different kinds, Canon 5Ds, all different like high def cameras, and they were just like, if these get broken, who cares?
So rad. That's intense.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. And it shows...
I want to go see it again now.
I know, right?
I'm going to... I haven't seen it in IMAX 3D yet. I saw it in regular. I'm going to go see it in IMAX 3D this week.
Did you see it in 3D or just 2D?
Just regular.
Okay.
Are you guys aware that there's a 4D theater downtown that's showing this movie?
Yeah, I was going to go see it, but I couldn't catch the time.
Like, someone that I went saw this movie, and they said afterwards they were physically tired because it was, like, shaking around so much. The chair moves.
Yeah, my friend saw Furious 7, and when she left, she was like, I kind of feel like I got my ass kicked in the theater, but it was awesome.
Yeah. All right, so we are going to introduce something new today, guys. And we don't really have a clever name for it, so if you're watching this and you think that we should call it something specific, we're going to call it either bold statement or thesis statement right now. But this is a thought about the movie that we each as like hosts and analysts have that is pretty strong. And I'm going to start with you, Steph. We're going to kind of go forward. She's going to defend this throughout the episode.
I don't know that I'm going to have to defend this one, but I'm going to say that this is the one of the most powerful action movies for women ever made.
Yeah, I mean, if you could think of the rest of the movies on that list, it would be an interesting list to make, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you got Kill Bill.
Right, but if you think about the empowering of what's happening here of a woman who's saving other women who have been abused to, you know what I mean? Like, they're all together trying to escape this man force. And it's funny, I've been reading about this a lot, and in a lot of things that I've read and researched, they're saying that this is a feminist film. A lot of men are pissed about this film.
Men's right activists?
Yeah, they are. The menifists.
It's a real thing.
It really is. Yeah, they're like annoyed with this film, and they're banning this film because there is so much women power. And it's crazy because it wasn't set out to be that way. It was set out to be equals, but because we live in a society where we're so used to it, and this is called Mad Max, we want it to be the male.
Right.
And so when the woman is equal, then, you know, it's created to this, oh, it's so feminist, but it was just an equal, which makes, you know, it seem that way.
It's funny that you say that because this movie is it's a testament to what we've talked about before, is the two heroes combine to make the perfect hero. They both need each other in this movie. It's not that Charlize just helps Max through the whole entire movie. They both need each other in very many instances. So I don't think that that's fair for people to be arguing that it's a feminist movie.
I think it's a pretty astute statement. And I definitely would say the knee-jerk reaction that most critics have had is that this is more of Charlize Theron's movie, really, as a character than
totally.
Hardy's. So what's yours? Oh, he's excited.
I'm scared to say it because it just scares me to even say it. I think this is the best action movie ever made.
What?
Yep.
The best action movie
best
of all
action
time?
Best action movie all time.
Come on.
This movie is not driven by plot. It's not driven by a great story or great acting. It's driven by just action. It's already in the IMDb's top 25 of their top 250. You look at the other movies on that list that are action movies. Don't even. You look at other movies that are on that list that are action movies. You've got Lord of the Rings. You've got Saving Private Ryan. You've got Pulp Fiction. These movies are all driven by something other than just... You don't even know what is going on in this movie till halfway through. That's when you figure out what the whole plot is.
I'm going to jump on your statement because mine is like it's almost like rephrasing the same statement. I just don't go with the first part of it. My statement is that the franchise involvement, the dialogue, and the story are almost totally irrelevant to enjoying this movie.
Absolutely. I would agree with that.
100%.
It's really just a giant explosion. It's a beautiful, giant explosion for an hour and 45.
An incredibly well choreographed explosion.
Yeah.
It actually makes you question the concept of what an action movie really is, and which we've done a lot of that on this show, of course.
Absolutely.
Because we try to establish the various categories at the end of the show, which will be a really interesting conversation. Maybe it'll be illuminated a bit more for myself by the end of the show, having talked about it some more, but it's hard to loop this in to one of the camps that already exists. What other movie can you think of that exists that is like this movie?
Exactly.
But I don't know if that makes it the greatest. I think
does,
that just makes
there's
it...
there's nothing... Like you said, there's
I'll
no
agree
plot.
It's in a class of its own.
Yeah.
That I'll agree with. But it's difficult to compare it. What can you compare it
well,
to?
Well, it's difficult to compare it, and I think the reason is because it's almost the bittersweet of the fact that you don't need to relate to this movie to enjoy it, but sometimes when people do relate to the movie, they enjoy it more, and therefore it would make it a more impactful film to be higher on that list. Mm-hmm. But anyone except people who don't like action would like this, and that's, I feel like, what some of the other great action movies do, is that plot gets people in to feel some emotion.
Right.
So if they don't just want to see shit blow up, they're like, oh, okay, there's a story here.
Right.
So I feel like, I don't know that I agree with that being the reason for that,
Sure.
But, I don't know, I see your point as well. Like, so, I can see both sides of it.
I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
So speaking of explosive stuff, stuff blowing up, we are going to get to our fist pump moments. We are doing it at the front of the show today because we are excited about them and we can't wait to unveil them. The fist pump moment, for those that are not aware of what it is a moment where you're watching the movie and you kind of have that subtle, like, yes, this is so awesome. I can't believe I get to watch the rest of this movie right now. You almost feel thankful to be watching the movie. So I'm going to start with you today, Drew.
I'm going to go first. Okay. This whole movie is a fist pump moment for me.
I know, right?
But yeah. I have two, and I hope I don't take either of your guys's. The opening monologue, even when it's just dark, and I hear Tom Hardy and him talk about, you know, I was a road warrior. Like,
right.
I love it. Like, from that moment, I was just like, yes. I don't even know how long this movie was. Like, I usually always look up runtime for movies.
2 minutes. I mean, 2 hours.
2 hours. I just didn't even care. I was just so ready. So from that beginning monologue, and then the next big one for me was when they'd just gotten away, or they're trying to get away, and you see this dust storm coming.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, what is going to happen in here? And then once you see what's in the dust storm, it gets even better. But just them going into it, and you see like a smaller car ride into the dust storm, it's just picked up and swept away immediately. You're like, wow, this thing is really, really powerful. So those are my two fist pump moments.
I'm going to have to say, I think I might change mine. No, because I have two as well. But I think for me, it was kind of when Morton Joe's face got ripped off.
Oh, spoilers, that, guys. Spoilers.
I mean, you said we were having spoilers.
Yeah. We already said it.
But it was kind of like, are you serious?
Oh, it
almost
so
went
great.
Tarantino on me with the blood. Like, it went very gory for a second, which I really liked. And I was like, he just got handed his ass. You know, like...
What does she
was,
say? She's like,
remember me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So a couple questions and thoughts on that. I want to talk about that scene in just a second, but I'm going to share my fist bump moment as well. I had a few that came to mind while I was watching. So oddly enough, the first one, but I changed it from this. Don't ask me why this is necessarily the reason, but there's that scene when Abby Lee is talking to one of the old women in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And she's giving her seeds.
Yeah.
I don't know why, for some reason, I was like, this is in the middle of, like, this absurd... I think it was just the concept that you have, like, the elderly women biker gang.
Yeah. And that was a moment, too. It was like, wait, they're all old women bikers.
Yeah,
like,
super
that
awesome.
Was, like, amazing.
But I was more just like, maybe that's just... I'm just into this movie. So when I really thought about it, I think that my fist pump moment was actually... When Morton Joe and his gang see that Tom Hardy, Charlize Theron, and the Warrior headed back to the Citadel, it's like, they're headed back to the Citadel!
Yeah.
And then the guitar guy's like, Morton just gets back and immediately just jumps on the truck.
Yeah, yeah.
The first thing he does, he just jumps out and says, like,
I love that he's there at every moment to set the tone with his heavy metal guitar. It's just so great throughout the whole thing.
He's really playing.
Yeah.
By the way, I was watching behind the scenes footage where the audio is super, super low. It's barely picked up. But if you listen closely, you can hear that he's actually playing guitar.
It's so rad.
It's a real thing.
It's a 132-pound guitar.
It's absurd.
It shoots flames.
It really shot flames.
Yeah.
It's like a real thing.
It's the whammy bar.
Awesome.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, whammy bar.
The drummers. It was just...
I got home and I looked at my guitars and I was like, you're not good enough. Like, you're not good enough. I'm sorry, I love you, but you're not good enough.
Put some sparklers on the end of your guitar.
Can I do my fist bump moment, guys?
Yeah,
oh, please
yeah.
do, Steven.
All right, I absolutely love this movie. I love Beyond Thunderdome. I love Road Warrior is the best Mad Max, mm-hmm. aside from this one. I gotta say, that's my favorite. My fist bump moment was, I was sitting in the theater, and I got four of my friends next to me, and we're all watching this movie, and I don't think anyone's as excited as I am. My girlfriend doesn't even know what the movie's about. But after that first scene, in that 80s-style credits just ram right into the screen, I was like, this is a fucking Mad Max movie. I was just so excited.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
You're very excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were so many fist pump moments.
Oh,
I could probably name like two
movie.
Or three
yeah.
more. Yeah, it was very like, you got out of there like jazzed.
Yeah,
yeah.
I totally agree.
I was amped.
Yeah.
I totally agree. But that was why my thought about all the irrelevance of the factors, because I walked out of the theater thinking like, what did I really just enjoy? And I was like, I just watched a huge cavalcade of action, and everything else around it was completely irrelevant to me. It didn't even have to be a Mad Max movie.
Right.
Can you say you just watched the greatest action movie of all time?
I don't know about that. But if you do think back, and I wonder too if, and again, like, I'm not trying to be all like women, men thing, but a lot of women that I know walked out of the theater not thinking that there wasn't an underlying plot from, you know, and like, again, it came in the middle, but there was a lot of women that did have been talking about that they had this equal role. Like, even the biker gang being right. elderly women,
so
you
cool.
know, even when you had Tom Hardy, when they had a few bullets left,
right.
and Zoe Kravitz yells, there's one bullet left, and
right.
he, like, hands the gun to Charlize Theron, she gets the shot.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, so I feel like women were more in tune to see that. And I also think, you know, the whole water, especially with, like you were saying
yeah.
earlier, what's happening here in California with the drought, like the human resources and how we fight over those resources. I feel like there is a lot. The blowing shit up totally trumps all of it and how awesome it is. But if, you know, thinking back or if you see it again because you're not wowed by all that the first time, I feel like there really is a good story here.
There's a lot of underlying tones throughout this movie
yeah.
that you are distracted by because of how fantastical everything else is.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's like visually amazing.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
It is. And we can talk about this more in production, but let's move in right now to star profiles.
Didn't you say you want to talk about the death a little bit more?
Yeah, we can get that in during the
right.
yeah,
I'm just
yeah.
excited. I'm excited. I'm sorry.
Yeah, agreed. So I want to get into star profiles. The two stars that are really that drive this movie are Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. And I want to look at just a little bit of sort of where their careers were in terms of well-reviewed or similar movies in the few years prior. So interestingly enough, if you look at Tom Hardy, you list The Drop in 2014, Dark Knight Rises in 2012, and Warrior in 2011. There's a lot of other movies he's done in the middle there. He's got like four, five, six other movies. But weirdly enough, for as sort of sexy of a star as he is in the world right now, he's like on the cover of Men's Health, and he's the
yeah.
guy. He's totally the it guy right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like him or Chris Pratt maybe, but I mean, I would say he's probably the it guy right now.
Definitely trumps Pratt.
Especially after this movie, because that
yeah.
dark, quiet,
yeah,
when he delivers, like,
yeah.
his role in this, there's such sex appeal to, because there's such mysterious, like, there's
yeah,
a lot
rugged,
more happening. Yeah.
I just say Chris Pratt, because back-to-back summers, you're going to have Guardians of the Galaxy and Jurassic World.
Yeah, I mean,
pretty
who
hard
knows
to
what
that.
We're going to say in
yeah.
a few
yeah,
weeks.
Yeah, but he's a little more bubble.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah,
but so Hardy is definitely the it guy.
Yeah.
But if you look at, like, what defines his career? I mean, what I have listed here, you have Inception, he's a secondary character in Inception, he's a character part.
Mm-hmm.
Bronson is an art house movie.
And it's old.
And it's old. Those are all old movies.
Yeah.
I mean, 2011, Warrior is ultimately an off-the-radar fighting movie that you have to sort of know about. It's great. I love it to death.
It's one of my favorites.
You know, Dark Knight Rises is the big one. That's the one that people knew Tom Hardy
right.
from, but you don't even see his face in the movie. He's wearing a mask
voice.
The whole time.
Yeah. Right.
Freak of the devil.
Yeah.
And then The Drop, which I watched on an airplane.
How was that? I never saw it.
It's just okay. It's
yeah.
pretty good.
Yeah.
He's pretty good in it. It's not anything special. I heard Locke was more interesting. I didn't see Locke.
I saw Locke, and I did like it, but, you know, the dude's in a car talking on the phone for an hour and a half. That's it.
Yeah. So yeah. it's very interesting that a guy could be the leader or the lead actor on the billboard for a tentpole like this and be sort of the it guy and not just like an art house guy. He's the guy right now.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be in every movie. He's got Revenant coming out next year with DiCaprio.
Leo.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, he's a big deal with the fall of the Birdman. But it's very interesting to me that he is sort of succeeding in this way that only a few guys that I can think of, in history, really movie stars that are super credible, super good looking, very, like they have all the sex appeal, but they managed to sort of be super famous without being cashing in.
He totally has that different look than the sex appeal. Like, you think about, like, look at Ryan Gosling, like, 2 years ago. Like, he was the guy. Or even
yeah.
a year ago.
Yeah.
Like, but he's a pretty boy. Like,
yeah.
even in Drive, you
but
know.
But he's got that roughness about him
he,
as well.
He
he's not
does.
That same pretty boy as Channing
but
Tatum.
But you look at Ryan Gosling and you look at Tom Hardy's body type.
Right.
Tom Hardy,
yeah.
he doesn't have a chiseled jawline.
He's stout.
He's stout. He's big, he's burly.
He's rugged,
like
he's a man.
He's a badass.
Yeah.
It's changing.
Yeah, it's fascinating, right? Like, the examples I can think of, the most famous ones of guys that were sort of like art house darlings and pretty boys that then they kept that for a while before they transitioned into just big time were like Johnny Depp and Brad Pitt.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
The two guys that are like, they were very good actors, people knew it, they recognized it, they managed to be credible until they tipped over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they're still credible, but it's like they tipped into commercialism.
Pitt's more credible than Depp still.
Yeah, but I just mean
yeah.
like Depp with Pirates, the first one, that's
right.
when he
yeah.
tipped into massive
Absolutely.
Commercial appeal. And with Pitt, I guess you would probably say somewhere around like the mid-2000s, like Troy era,
right.
or just before maybe.
Yeah,
you know.
But I think Pitt still can pull off. He could have played this. Not
I think
spoiled,
he could have.
He's
yeah.
got that ruggedness
yeah.
about him that I don't... I mean, Johnny Depp, yeah, like you're saying, like he had it. But even when he had it, I think like, you know, if you think about Pitt and like Fight Club and stuff, like he has that, because it's almost rugged but slightly deranged as well.
Mm-hmm. What it is
Hardy is good at doing that.
Yeah,
you transition from being a not only like a media darling and like an art house darling, you transition into your name on the billboard is more important than anything you could possibly do in the movie. That's what happens. And Hardy is reaching the point where he's going to be that guy, but he's not there yet. So it's really interesting to see this movie. And we'll talk about this more. This was not really, like, the fact that this was as good as it is a complete surprise to everyone.
Yeah.
It looked horrible. 2 months, 3 months ago when I saw the trailer, I was like,
really?
I was like,
oh, I'm completely, no, what I thought from the beginning, and that trailer is the longest trailer that I've seen. I know they produced, what, 7 for this one?
Yeah.
But I feel like the beginning trailers, to me, almost, hear me out before you jump on me, go down as some of the best trailers for me ever.
I'm a trailer
because
junkie.
This is why
I disagree.
Well, this is why, because I'm almost the exact opposite. I hate, you look at so many movies today, the whole movie's in the freaking trailer. Mm-hmm. So when you had the trailers of just them coming across the desert, you know, when they had just the trucks and an explosion here, and they don't this last trailer almost told you 80% of what happens in the movie.
Right.
So I like the tease trailers that they were doing in the beginning that didn't, because you got the feel and you heard the noise and it just gives you chills and then you don't know. I feel nowadays a lot of trailers really take away from the end product because you know what you're going into. Oh. And that's why, not because I thought it was the best produced trailer ever, but it gave me that, I want to see this. I don't know what I'm going for, but I kind of do know what I'm going for. It's going to be sick.
Yeah. You know, I absolutely agree. I don't know if I agree that it's one of the greatest trailers ever made, but I also don't think that when I saw the first trailer a couple months ago, I wasn't on board. Like, I was stoked. I was ready.
Right.
I did have a moment in the movie where when he's running and he jumps and he hooks onto that crane, I thought from day one, first trailer, that like that's how he gets away.
Yeah.
That's how he gets away in the very beginning. And then you realize that he gets pulled back in. And I really like that, because when I watched the trailer, I was like, oh, really? They're going to show us how he gets away in the very beginning of the trailer the movie, blah, blah, blah. But no, I love the trailer. I definitely don't think it's one of the greatest trailers ever made, but I do love it. All of them.
You know, it's funny because, let's be honest, guys, Mad Max, the Mad Max franchise at this point, is very dated. If you go back to watch those old movies, I watched the first two this week just to kind of prep. I remember seeing The Road Warrior as a kid, and Thunderdome was on TV a bunch when I was growing up, so I remember these movies, but you know, in the way that this movie's post-apocalyptic vision of the future is very sort of ambiguous to the era, The Road Warrior looks like it's an 80s version of the future.
Yeah.
Because all of the, like, pastel headbands and, like, it's just very 80s. You know, it looks like the Motley Crue video looks to kill. It's like...
Yeah.
And so it's the kind of, like... what's like the word you're looking for? It's like sort of like a nerd darling, this trilogy. It's the kind of people that like all these kind of movies, these 80s, very campy,
yep.
And they have a huge attachment to them in a lot of cases because they grew up watching them. But if you go back and you compare those old movies to this movie, it's not even the same discussion. Like, it's really not even in the same world.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with the costume. There's a lot, you know, a lot of it just has to do with the look of it as well. Mm-hmm. From that campy look to a more... you know, rougher, edgy, rugged, badass look.
So my point is that when I saw you associate those old Mad Max movies with Mel Gibson.
Absolutely. Right.
Mel Gibson.
He was in all of them.
Right. Mel Gibson at this point in his career now in the modern consciousness is kind of a joke. He's not a bad actor. It's just he's not taken seriously in the way that he was during Braveheart era, you know, or these movies.
He's not even talked about it anymore.
Yeah, no. People just don't care. Yeah. So when I saw the trailers, I was like, really? A studio put money behind another Mad Max movie? I was like, I don't care. Those old movies are campy. I was like, I wouldn't choose to go watch them again if they were re-released. Why would I see this? So for me, I was like, this just looks crazy. I don't know what I'm getting into. But aside from Tom Hardy, which is the reason that I paid attention, which is the reason most people paid attention, I think, you know, anyway, it kind of blew my mind. Let's move on to Charlize Theron before we just go on and on. So Charlize Theron, totally unique actress. Like, really.
And she's amazing.
Yeah, incredible. Her three most sort of recent hits would be Prometheus in 2012, Snow White and the Huntsman also in 2012, and Young Adult in 2011. Now, I wouldn't have included Young Adult because I know it's, like, not really at all the same genre. But it was a movie some people saw. I've heard people talk about it. Yeah. People liked it. The Road was a little older. That would be the one that is way more
she's
on the
not,
same
she's
level.
She's hardly in that movie, but that movie is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Very good.
It's just so depressing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the darkest movie.
I love depressing movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Later.
So Theron is significantly... she's not older that significantly, but she's at a significantly later portion of her career than Hardy, for sure. Hardy is really hitting his stride in the last 3 years. Theron is sort of in that. She's coasting.
Yeah, she's kind of done it all already. She's already won Academy Award, you know. Like,
yeah.
She's
she could win
fun.
Another Oscar next year if the right part came along. Yeah. She could also not be in a movie for 5 years and we'd probably still see something in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, just be in campaigns and show up to red carpets. That's all it really takes. She's beautiful. Like, she's still beautiful. She'll be beautiful in 5 years.
Yeah.
Even in this movie where I felt like she had aged a little bit.
She looks great.
She looks great. It's almost...
She looks awesome. And I feel like it takes a certain kind of woman to play this role. And I think that sometimes they can try and it's done poorly. And I think she nailed it.
So when we recast this later, it'll be really interesting to talk about. Because it's very hard to find someone who can fill these shoes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's that character in the movie. Like we've talked about in Air Force One, Gary Oldman, The Rock. You talk Ed Harris.
Yeah.
She's the reason that this movie is so great. Even though I love Tom Hardy. And that's because I have like a man
I don't think
crush,
either one of them
crush.
Matter. I think you could slot like...
I don't know, man. I really think that Charlize really carries this movie.
I think you'd get 90% of the same appeal if you put almost anyone in those roles.
I don't know. Okay, so maybe you'd get the same appeal, but would you get a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes?
No way.
I mean, maybe the movie wouldn't be as good in that sense. I think I'd walk out of the movie still being like, I just watched this incredible action movie. I don't walk away from this going, I loved this movie because Charlize Theron sold me. I go, that car chase scene that lasted an hour and 20 minutes, basically,
right. But if she didn't keep it going, it would have made it more campy and it would have taken away. It allowed it to be on the same playing field with the awesomeness of action.
Let me rephrase that. I don't think she was bad in any way. I think she was great.
Yeah.
I just don't think that she would, in another, like...
Oh, I think there's a bunch
she's
of women
not
that could have ruined it.
I don't think she's the reason that this movie was awesome. I do think women could have ruined it. I just don't think that she is important to the movie.
She
success.
Grounds this movie in between the crazy chase scenes, her performances. I mean, when she finds out that the city's gone, that scream she gives out in the desert, she's a phenomenal actress.
Yeah.
She brings this movie together.
Yeah, okay. I agree. I definitely disagree with you, Ben. I think that she is... Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's a key point.
A cog in the machine.
Yeah. Without her, this movie isn't this movie.
She's one of those rare actresses that, despite... She's able to play within 10 or 15 years of her age, it feels like. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like young adult, she plays someone who's like 29 or something like that. And that was like a couple years ago.
Right.
Or 31 or something. And she looks totally believable.
Yeah.
But not only that, she's such a... Like, besides her age and her look, she's such a well-rounded character. She allows herself to go there.
Yeah.
And she doesn't care. She's strong in this movie. She's vulnerable. She's tough. She's everything. She's... All the she gets emotional. Yeah, it's like she uses everything in her for this role. And I feel like not a lot of actors are that good at delivering all that in something, especially with the conditions they're filming in and all that. Like, she's, I don't know.
I think she's one of the most, she's definitely one of the most physically commanding, just in like the way that they did with her eyes, too.
Yeah.
Like, really, really a physically commanding presence. So that, I think, sells her more than most people on screen. But I don't know that her performance is like, paramount to it, but anyway, let's move on. Let's move on to production development. I want to talk about how this movie got made, and it's a really interesting one, just because there are so many. I mean, there are parallels to the old Mad Max movies. The wonderful thing about this is that this is truly, they say, from Mastermind George Miller on the billboard. It's the same production team that did the first three Mad Max movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the same. He produced it with the same people. Even some of the actors are the same. It's people that he's used forever. And it's incredible because but if you go back and watch those old movies like I just did, there's not as many parallels as you'd think. Like, in terms of like, oh, this is a nod to this. There's like two or three.
Like, yeah, like
a couple,
the music box.
The music box,
it is.
Yeah.
There's like things here and there. Because I went back and watched, I was able to find Mad Max on YouTube. And
yeah.
First of all, it was pretty tough to watch after watching Fury Road. And
the first one, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Road Warrior is definitely more enjoyable. But yeah, you're right. There's really not that many.
Yeah.
Parallels, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, you said the music box, and he still has the brace on from when he gets shot in the leg in Mad Max, and there's a few things. One really cool thing is that, so Hugh Keyes-Byrne, who plays Immortan Joe, is actually the actor that plays Toe Cutter in Mad Max.
Yep.
Yeah.
So he's the villain in both movies. Different character, but same actor, which is kind of fascinating. And the great thing is at the end of Mad Max, when he's talking to Mel Gibson's wife, who gets run over by a motorcycle, goes under the wheels, if you will. He says to her, he's making a joke, and he says something about if I took your face off. He's like, if you've got this sense of humor, but if I took your face off, that's what Toe Cutter says. And then it's ironic that he gets his face ripped off,
yeah.
And, you know, 30 years later, So anyway, that is kind of interesting. But so let's just first talk about George Miller. So Miller is a guy who had gone to medical school. He was working as an emergency room doctor in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And he met this guy, Byron Kennedy. And he met him in, I think, they were working on an experimental film together in 1971. And so they decided to start kind of working on, they won some awards, you know, young filmmakers and things like that. And this is in Australia, mind you. So they work on things together. He graduates. He starts working as an emergency room doctor. They save a bunch of money. They spend most of the money they have with Kennedy Miller, which is their production company they create, to make Mad Max. And they make it for, we'll talk about the budget later, but $365,000. And the movie goes on to make an enormous amount of money, break all kinds of records, and spawn the whole franchise. And that's what really launches the whole career. But had this movie been a flop, George Miller would have been a doctor.
Right.
What a terrible thing to fall back on.
I know.
He was a doctor. He was working in emergency rooms. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I think when you say mastermind George Miller, it's just... This movie just epitomizes that, man. And even in Tom Hardy at Cannes Film Festival, he apologizes publicly. Yeah. He says, you know, there was times when we were shooting the movie and it just seemed so complex and so just like... Just ridiculous. It was too much for what was happening. Like, this plot is so simple and so linear. Why is all this happening? And then the first time he saw the movie, he was like, I immediately had to apologize to George because I had no idea what I was talking about. This is a masterpiece.
Yeah. It is, yeah, it is totally insane in that sense. You think about every one of those stunts. I was talking to you guys during the trailer, but I'll say it again. If anybody's interested, just YouTube behind the scenes Mad Max Fury Road, because the first YouTube video is just handheld footage of 20 minutes of just a cam just on behind the scenes, and it goes chronologically through the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it's so crazy. We'll show some of this a little later, but it's like they do 90% of the stunts in this movie. 90% of the stunts are done practically.
Crazy.
And they are insane.
Yeah.
Which is a testament to you, Academy, right now. This is me, Andrew Guy, talking to you, Academy.
Listen up.
Give us a stunt coordinator Academy Award. This movie is insane. How can you not give credit to these guys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
90% of this is real? Are you kidding me?
I'm floored that doesn't exist.
Yeah. They voted against it in what? Did
2011, I think you said?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
It's crazy.
Pretty nuts. George Miller makes this movie. His next two movies are made with Kennedy Miller and Byron Kennedy, who unfortunately dies in a helicopter crash in 1983.
Right.
So he's working on this movie. Doug Mitchell comes on. It's another guy he knows. Kind of replaces him in terms of the production development, the partner. They do all three of the movies together. And from that point, after 1985, he doesn't do another Mad Max movie until this one. Right. So there's a massive gap. There's a 30-year gap. And some of the movies that George Miller wrote and directed are going to kind of blow your mind, listeners. So to name a few, the ones that are like dramatic or interesting that you might be like, okay, I could see. He does, in 87, he has Witches of Eastwick.
Which is the last R-rated movie he directed.
Yeah.
Right.
30 years ago. Almost.
Which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, Witches of Eastwick is good.
I wouldn't be like... I wouldn't be, you know, crazy about that one. I'd be like, okay, that makes sense. He did that.
He does Lorenzo's Oil in 1992, which is, you know, that was a movie that was, it had some Academy Award nominations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's well respected. Here's some of the others. He wrote Babe 1. He wrote and directed Babe 2, Pig in the City.
Phenomenal.
He wrote and directed Happy Feet 1 and 2.
That's amazing.
Happy Feet.
Yeah.
So here's a good piece of trivia.
Didn't that get that one an Academy Award, right?
Happy Feet.
Yeah.
So he was all set to shoot this movie, Mad Max, because he's been working on this movie for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's had the concept for a long time, and he was set to start shooting. He came up with the idea in 1998, and he was going to start shooting in 2001. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, September 11th happened.
Yeah.
So the U.S. dollar plummeted, and he couldn't get financing, and he had to direct Happy Feet instead.
Right.
That was the movie that he started working on instead. They're like, sorry, you can't make Mad Max, George. Can you make Happy Feet? Okay, I'll do Happy
sure,
Feet.
Sure, that's a good thing to do.
It's a good comp. He's gone on record as saying that he doesn't feel, and this is not a direct quote, but he's gone on record as saying that he doesn't feel there is an enormous difference between directing a Mad Max movie and a Happy Feet. It's all just story. They're all the same to him, which I think is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because I would assume Mad Max would be a lot more fun. I mean, maybe not anyone, but come on, like, I feel like everyone likes an explosion, everyone likes a firework, everyone likes a boom, you know?
What a lovely day!
No,
he loves it.
But you have to be a little bit, in my book, I would, you know, it's like some people, like, if the dog doesn't like you, you're weird, or if you don't like dog, like, if you don't like seeing shit blow up, to me, you're a little weird in my book.
Yeah.
hundreds of millions of dollars worth of explosion? Dancing penguins.
Yeah.
Which one?
It's crazy. So yeah. So this movie went through a number of iterations while he was working on it, but different casting choices,
right,
and different production dates.
2003, they were going to try to do it again.
With Mel Gibson.
With Gibson,
but then the Iraq War happened, and shooting in Africa was just not possible.
And he got pulled into Passion of the Christ, and he was starting to become a very controversial character, and Miller didn't want to have to do the movie with him. So we talked on the Edge of Tomorrow episode about Bruce Berman. Bruce Berman is this crazy, crazy producer in Hollywood. I think he's the CEO of Village Roadshow.
Yeah.
And he has directed, we named him last time, I'll list the same ones. American Sniper.
Yeah.
American Sniper, Mystic River, Ocean's 11, The Matrix, Training Day, and about 90 other movies.
Yeah.
Edge of Tomorrow. I mean, the guy is, I nicknamed him Bruce. All I do is win Berman on our outline here.
You gotta
chuckle
with
that.
Yeah. He's just, he doesn't lose. It's like 9 out of 10 movies that he'll sign on to make or put money behind. He as an EP, he just wins.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, this movie, think about this. 30 years later, we're going to revive a franchise that starred one actor who's incredibly controversial and no longer relevant.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go off of a script that is comprised of 3,500 storyboarded panels.
Exactly. Before there was a script.
Before
there was just storyboard panels. Yeah.
It's basically just a giant chase scene. I mean, Miller was ready to make this thing as a 3D film. He was going to make it as a 3D animation.
Yep.
He almost did it. So you as a producer have to say to yourself, this sounds like a good enough concept. I'm going to put a bunch of money. They spent $150 million on this movie, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm going to put a bunch of money behind this. It's going to succeed. The guy is unstoppable.
He's
Bruce
a genius.
Berman. Yeah. I feel like we should have like something on this show called like the Berman rule or something like that.
Like if he produced it, it's allowed
winning
on the show.
Yeah.
Or like would Berman, like what would Berman do?
Yeah.
WWBD.
Yeah.
Amazing. Find me a producer who has a more impressive filmography and my mind will be blown.
Yeah, totally.
So then you have Ian Smith as another guy. He's a Scottish producer. He did, the only reason I mentioned him, I mean, a lot of, there was like 9 producers on this, I think. But Ian Smith had worked on Children of Men, Cold Mountain, Fifth Element. Some movies that in some ways have similar feels. Epics, post-apocalyptic. He kind of understood it. He's won awards in Scotland. So he's a guy worth mentioning. But ultimately, the thing I like so much about George Miller and about Byron Kennedy Miller, which they added... Byron Kennedy Mitchell. Doug Mitchell is the other producer. I like that it seems like he's sort of a family-oriented production guy. Like he likes to use the same people. He works with the same team. A lot of people that have worked on those old movies have worked on these. If you look through the producers of all those Happy Feet and Babe Pig in the City and all those movies, it's a lot of the same people. Same writers, same producers. So that's really cool. The guy's 70 years old. It's amazing to see that he could keep his career together for this long with the same number of people and have another hit. And it's his most visually striking movie that he's ever made.
It's incredibly respectable.
Yeah. Very, very cool. So that's like his directing credits. You know, obviously he wrote and directed the first Mad Max and Mad Max 2, Mad Max 3.
Right.
And
you know, you talk about the original Mad Max costing 300 something thousand.
Yeah.
And this movie was made for $150 million, which without inflation is 300 times the budget.
Right.
With inflation, it comes out to be like 150 times the budget, which is just insane. Like, absolutely insane. Like, and that's why I think when we go back to watch the old Mad Max, it's really hard to hop on board with it after watching this movie the same week.
Yeah.
Right, but that's not what they're meant to do. I mean, I know you both are saying that, but in the 80s, it was great.
Oh, I totally agree.
Like,
it's been dated.
Everything's changed, and so is everything, but it's still kind of... It still stands alone. And that's the thing about this movie, too, for me, is yes, you know, we've all seen the old ones, but if you've never seen a Mad Max movie before, this one kind of stands alone, and you don't need all of the backstory.
It completely
stands
alone.
There's no backstory to this.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I think that's why my comment about its relation to the franchise, it's not a Mad Max movie. There's almost nothing about this.
It's a reboot that isn't a prequel or a sequel. It's not. You don't even know if it's the same Max
or
not.
They revisit a few things, but it's not.
Miller says in interviews, he says that this is supposed to be...
Standalone, right?
Yeah, it's not supposed to take place in the chronology of the story. It's just supposed to be...
It's like they got the band back together and made a new movie.
Yeah.
Because even some of this, I had heard it's supposed to take place 40 years later. That doesn't make any sense if he's the same age. There's one theory that the kid from Fury or from...
The feral child.
Yeah,
from Road Warrior with the feral child with the boomerang. That's actually who he is because he has the music box, which wouldn't make any sense because he says he used to be a cop. The kid was never a cop.
Right.
You just don't know. So anyway, that's sort of the production development. We'll get a bit more into
money.
Yeah. And so we should mention it was filmed in Namibia. Over, I think, 120 days, there were a number of reshoots, script revisions, though the script was pretty small to begin with. They were going to shoot in Broken Hill, which is in South Wales, basically Australian countryside. But because there were heavy rains that year, and it turned into a very sort of like lush green desert, they had to move it.
Yeah, that doesn't work really for this movie.
No,
you can't do it.
Wouldn't be the
which
same.
Is they also shot this movie in sequence, which... You almost never see in movies ever anymore, especially a movie like this.
Right.
It was shot in sequence, which I find that incredibly fantastic. Like, that's just very impressive to me. And also, they had, what, like 5 camera crews going all at the same time?
Yeah.
Like, instead of just like Team A and Team B, there was like 5 teams going all at once, all shooting at the same time, all in unison. Like, that's, again... George Miller's a genius.
Well, so one thing that he was saying in an interview that I watched, and again, I should have direct quotes, but I mean, they're long. So to paraphrase what he was essentially saying was that one thing he learned with animated films was that when you choose with an animated film for a specific shot, it's your perspective on that exact shot, right? Mm-hmm. So I know exactly where I want to shoot this frame.
Right.
He said shooting with animation, or not shooting, but creating animation, was one of the most illuminating things to him in terms of camera movement. So a shot could look so different by just moving the camera from one angle to another, from further away, from closer in. You could get so much more emotion. You could get so much more out of a shot with just moving the camera. And I think it's really evidence that, you know, he comes back to do this movie after doing a couple animated films, and this is what he gets, is this total bananas insanity visual masterpiece.
Yeah, and he was telling his cinematographer, keep that lead, or the actor, the one that you're supposed to be focusing on in the scene, in the crosshairs of the camera.
Right.
And this is something that the cinematographer wasn't used to. Like, he's cutting off actors on both sides of the screen all the time. But the reason is that this movie is so high octane, there's so much going on all the time, that if the lead, or whoever you're supposed to be paying attention to, is in the center of the screen, it's easy to follow. And that's one thing about this movie, with how much that's going on in this movie. And mind you, there's so much going on in this movie that the CG that was used was to take out real explosions, real stunt explosions, because it was too visually stimulating.
Yeah, 90% of it is real. So the CGI is, so you take out explosions, you take out the wires for the stunts, you take out Charlize Theron's arm, and there's the lightning storm.
Yeah.
Everything else is real. It's all practical stunts.
Incredible.
Yeah, watch that video, guys. It was like my jaw was dropping. I was just like, I could not believe you guys were jumping motorcycles over moving vehicles, and the guys on the poles.
The bending poles.
That was the coolest thing. That was the best. Yeah. I kind of want to do that. And I want to be on the front of the hood.
Yeah.
So I want to be hood ornament.
So we'll get to that in a second. I do want to quickly touch on box office.
I want to be a hood ornament. I love it.
Box office and critical. So Warner Brothers makes this movie, $150.4 million, opens against Pitch Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
$44 million domestically opening weekend. Pitch Perfect brought in $67. That's kind of unfortunate.
It is. But Mad Max did beat Pitch Perfect worldwide by like $2 million. So that makes me happy.
Sure.
They kind of won in the end, I guess.
But it makes sense.
Totally.
Maybe it's unfortunate, but it totally makes sense. Mad Max and what it was in the past, which again, we've all decided it's not, you know, trying to be that again. But you think about it, a lot of people might be like, I might not understand that. I don't know. Pitch Perfect, so many people can enjoy, and it's a larger demo for that movie.
Just totally being PG-13.
And I'm sorry, Pitch Perfect 2 was amazing. Just gonna say it.
Take your word for it.
I won't go into it. No, it's worth seeing. I promise you a dinner that if you go to that movie and don't like it, I will go buy you dinner.
All right.
If you don't laugh out loud at least once, I will,
wherever you want. Can I come?
This is A and B, man.
Yeah.
So it loses to Pitch Perfect. One of the amazing things is Avengers in its third weekend still made $37 million.
Yeah, it only beat it by, $7 million?
Yeah.
$7 million. And
it's Avengers.
Yeah, it's great, but it's totally nuts. I mean, one thing we've talked about on the show, and I was noticing again today, is that, you know, basically, I would say that, like, what Mad Max and Guardians of the Galaxy show us is that tone is king. Because you can take a property that is, in theory, a disaster from a studio perspective, a studio that says, I don't want to spend $150 million to make this movie,
right,
and you can say, look, if I do it right, it doesn't matter that this is a Mad Max reboot 30 years later called Fury Road without Mel Gibson. It doesn't matter that this is Guardians of the Galaxy, this totally throwaway comic that was like a novelty book from 1989. If we do it right, we put the right people in it, and the script is good, it's going to be a good movie. And they're right.
Right.
So it's incredible to see that in the 90s and the mid-2000s, when the studios were throwing money at superhero movies and franchise movies, and they were saying, look, we're just going to rely on the fact that this is Fantastic Four. We're going to rely on the fact that this is Spider-Man to make these good movies. They were wrong. You can't just make a bad movie because it has Spider-Man in it. Right. You can't make a bad movie because it has Fantastic Four in it.
Right.
If it's bad, it's bad. Nobody's going to see it. So I think that's really fascinating that this movie did actually get greenlit. I have a feeling George Miller was like, the only way I can make this movie that I want to make is if I call it Mad Max. if I throw all the successful franchise.
You know what's funny? I was just thinking about that while you were talking about that. I wonder if this movie would have had nothing to do with Mad Max and it looked slightly different as a new, brand new action movie, how would it have done?
That's interesting.
I wonder. Because you get that built-in audience because of the old Mad Max. But again, so will this movie, now that all the people that loved the franchise long ago probably went to see it by now, opening weekend, is it going to dwindle off and not do better at the box office?
I think actually quite the reverse. I think the word...
Okay, that's interesting.
I think that the general consensus that I got from most people that I talked to about this movie when they saw the trailer was that sort of like, well, I mean, it looks... So it's Mad Max. Like, maybe. Right. I probably won't see it. It looks kind of ridiculous. You know, Mel Gibson, I'm not interested. I think the reaction has been so overwhelming. It's still at 98% Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, it's
the greatest action movie of all time rating, if I may say so.
It is the highest rated film on Tomatoes in George Miller's career, mm-hmm. in Tom Hardy's career, and in Charlize Theron's career. Theron has won an Oscar.
For a fantastic... Like, Monster is an incredible movie.
George Miller
won
an Oscar.
Which is amazing, because there's definitely not going to be an Oscar one for this movie.
Maybe effects.
Maybe effects. I almost wish he would get a nod for director.
That bugs me for a minute, because if it does go for effects, the fact that stunt coordination and all this stuff isn't included in
makeup,
that.
It'll probably win for makeup.
Maybe costume, makeup, wardrobe.
Yeah, set design.
Well, that's the one thing about the set, is that George Miller, he's like, I don't want my post-apocalyptic movie to look like others, which is why this is so colorful. Yeah. And there's so much going on. And like, you look at the dust storm.
Yeah.
So cool. You know, that's just incredible.
It's Burning Man.
Unbelievable. Mentioned this, and I looked at the pictures you sent me.
Yeah.
Unreal. It looks like real life Mad Max.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So, have you been?
No, my sister. She goes every year. She tells me about it, and she raves.
It's amazing. So you guys out there, if you want a Mad Max experience, you need to go to Burning Man. I sent some pictures. I don't know if we got them to come up, but they've built the Thunderdome. Mm-hmm. They do the challenge. Two men enter, one man leaves. The cars that you're allowed to, like, once you get there and park your car, you're only allowed to drive what they call mutant vehicles, which look a lot like the war cars.
Yeah.
I mean, people are on, there's fire everywhere. It's amazing. It's so, so, so amazing. And it's
what a lovely day!
It's that. People go around saying that. But it's really, you know, if you want to, look up Burning Man, and there's a lot of pictures that would do this, and it's an experience you can have, and it's, you know, pretty much a live Mad Max.
One more thing about the budget is that not only is it did it lose to Pitch Perfect, which is a sequel and it's very successful, it's also against the top movies of 2015. You've got Avengers, you've got Furious 7, and Cinderella that are all still in theaters.
Right.
So that's a testament to how good it is and how much people wanted to see it.
It's also interesting, you know, if we put up the graphic here from 20 years ago, we like to do this where we show the same weekend 20 years ago.
You know,
Die Hard with a Vengeance opened that same weekend in 1995, mm-hmm. right? And as we talked about it with Speed, there's a huge shift that's going on with the earlier weekends versus the later weekends in the summer, right? Summer starts in April now. So, you know, Die Hard 3 is sort of the only movie that really opens that weekend. You have Crimson Tide, which at the time was, you know,
whatever.
Kind of just like a whatever action.
Yeah.
I don't think they were like hitching their wagon to it. I don't even know what Forget Paris is. If I should have seen it, please tweet me and let me know. And then you have, you know, While You Were Sleeping, Friday is still in theaters, Bad Boys. So basically, there was no movie that was a surprise, like a runaway hit like this. Like, this is, I would characterize this, I think the studio honestly probably looked at this movie because they showed it to test audiences. They had to go into reshoots because the test audiences didn't like it.
Really?
For this one?
For Mad Max.
Okay.
Yeah, that's, it shot for 120 days from the beginning, I believe, of 2012, to the, like, you know, 4 months in 2012. And then in September or October of 2012, they had to go back for reshoots because test audiences didn't like it. Yeah, so they had to, I have a feeling, and this
I wonder
is,
what they changed.
I wonder what they didn't like.
This is just me, postulating, but like, there's four different scenes or three different scenes in the final 30 or 40 minutes of the movie where it goes to black and reopens. It fades and reopens, and you're like, oh, is it over? Oh, it's back. Oh, is it over? It's back.
You're right.
There's one early after the lightning storm where they wake up.
Right.
That one I think is maybe planned. I think the later ones I have a feeling have something to do with those reshoots.
Interesting.
That would be my guess, but. Definitely an interesting movie to see how it does in the coming weekends.
Right.
I think it's somewhere in the range of like domestically up to like 56 by now. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if this can, you know, make its money back.
I'd be shocked if it didn't at this point with how much people love this
movie.
The
word of mouth is pretty bananas.
It's just too much.
Totally. So the first Mad Max one was made for $350,000. The second one was made for $4.5 million. And the third one was made for $12 million. Now, the first movie ended up in Australia making a bunch of money and then coming to the U.S. and is largely credited for popularizing new wave Australian cinema in the United States. Mm-hmm. It made $100 million in the U.S. in 1979.
Yeah, that's massive.
Like, yeah. That's – and it held records for years, decades, as the most profitable movie in, of all time in the Guinness Book of World Records. Like 27
did
years.
Did Blair Witch end up taking over for it? Was that what it was?
I don't know. I'm not exactly sure what movie holds the record now, but I mean I know it was more than 20 years that held the record.
Wow.
That's awesome.
So – yeah, it's you know, being hailed as a great film. Thoughts before we move into what we would call the ultimate action scene, which is just the whole movie.
Right. My thoughts a little bit about this whole, I don't know. I feel like with movies like this, somehow the word of mouth and the way that we have technology and social media now plays into a large part of what happens with these kind of films.
I would agree.
The fact that, you know, so to compare these to films, you know, in the 80s again with this list, it's almost hard to do because, you know, when Die Hard was out, you couldn't look on your Twitter and see one of your friends be like, man, I just saw Die Hard, it was awesome. Right. And then me feel like, oh, cool, I should go.
Right.
It was kind of just the immediate people you talk to, and maybe even on TV, there wasn't as many entertainment weeklies or, you know, shows reviewing this stuff. So I feel like that's why it's a whole different almost set of rules in the business now. So I feel like sometimes it's hard to compare what stuff
did. Absolutely.
It,
I mean,
you know,
I have a thousand, let's say you have 1,000 Twitter followers in real life. You'd maybe talk to 20 of those people while the movie's running. Whereas
not
you
even
just tweet out.
Like, how many people are you going to go tell, like,
right,
you
like,
went to a movie? Maybe 10? Five.
Yeah, exactly.
So I feel like that it's hard because it changes the game a little bit.
It's weird how our culture, like the critical response works now, because like I said, I think that the vast majority, this isn't like Avengers 2 where a year ahead of time everybody knew it was coming and was like, I can't wait for Avengers 2.
No,
I know just what to expect.
Exactly.
You know, I can't wait to expect. Oh, it came out. It was everything I expected. It was great. It makes all this money. This movie was like, I feel like the only reason we're talking about it is because it's awesome. We wouldn't be talking about it if it was bad. If it was bad,
it blew the world away.
If it was bad, it would be that movie that flopped that we didn't care about.
Right. As in, if the Avengers 2 was bad, we would still talk about it because we would have talked about how it was bad. For this,
exactly.
It just would have like, okay, let's talk about
the
other one.
Wouldn't even be on the show. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we wouldn't even talk about doing it.
I agree
it.
With you.
So I do think that's really interesting, and that's the power of social media. So we normally do the sort of the entire action, or we do the ultimate action scene here on the show, where we talk about what we think is maybe the most difficult scene to shoot or the most interesting or memorable scene. We'll kind of break the whole thing down. This whole movie is that scene, really, aside from 25 minutes roughly of like a little bit of dialogue here and there.
That's dispersed throughout the film.
Yeah, and it's so short. Most of the movie is just a huge chase scene.
Yeah.
And so there's just a bunch of notes that we took that we just sort of want to talk about. Things that you might not know about shooting the car chase, some of the more like miraculous stunts. The first one that comes to mind for me are those poles.
Yeah.
So I have a couple behind the scenes videos that we're going to roll for you right now. And kind of chat over, but there's no sound on them, or that it's extremely muted, so you can just sort of see a few things that's going on. You guys haven't seen these?
I haven't yet. I'm excited to watch them.
Yeah. So a couple things, like,
God.
So you think, guys, this is them practicing, and then you in a couple, in like about a minute here, you're going to see them actually driving doing this.
That's just insane.
I so want to go play.
Look at that.
Yeah, like it's like you talk about, you know, 150 stunt performers, some of whom were Cirque du Soleil members.
Totally makes sense.
Oh, they had to be.
Some of whom were Olympic athletes.
Yep.
I mean, that's the kind of person that's doing something like this.
Just the core strength to be able to do that, pick someone up. It's just, oh my gosh.
It's totally insane. Like, mind kind of blown watching it. I was just watching this, and as I was saying, my jaw was just kind of dropping. Look at this. That's real.
Those are real people. Audience, those are real people.
I so want to go do that. Do you guys not want to be on that?
Real people.
Am I the only one that feels that way?
On driving cars with poles. So,
Jeez. So
that's like sort of the scope of what they are working with on this movie.
Right.
Right? That's like, that's essentially, you know, you're in the desert and you're with 150 stunt performers, and the stunt team with the cameras they have like something ridiculous, like 18 cameras, you know, all different varieties, crash cams.
Well, because you never know what you're going to get.
Right.
You can't physically know exactly how that scene's going to look when you're dealing with all these variables and you're actually using human beings, not CGI. So that's why I'm sure they want so many cameras and you only have a couple chances to do it right. God forbid somebody gets hurt. You know what I mean? So I feel like that makes sense why they have so many cameras.
Well, and it's also insane. Like, so John Seale is the cinematographer and he had worked with Miller in the past.
Yeah. He came out of... Oh, is that what you're saying?
He came out of retirement to do this movie. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he must have had so much faith. That's an Oscar. This might win best cinematography.
It should.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to envision the way you're going to shoot something like that, some guys swinging on poles and the way this all works, and string the whole thing together. And as we said, before the script was ever created, there was a 3,500-panel storyboard, just an animated storyboard. And Miller, at one point, was going to make it into a 3D animation based on the storyboard. Mm-hmm. The actual shots in the film end up being almost exactly 3,500. It almost matches exactly.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So a couple other things to point out. Miller invited playwright Eve Ensler to act as an on-set advisor.
Vagina monologues.
Yeah. So she was impressed with the script and with the depth and the feminist themes, and she was seen on set, like, counseling and consulting people and, like, just sort of... It's just sort of a funny thing to think about, that she would have somebody this, like, you know, women, strength, power type of personality on set.
See, I disagree with you, because you think it's a funny thing because you're a dude. Like, well, to have these women have to... No, but, like, that to have these women have this counsel, to have to... let them know what to feel like. She's taken experiences from, like, these women that are raped and beaten in the Congo, and showing these other women who are actors that, you know, hopefully have not dealt with this stuff, how to act, mannerisms, this, that, and the other thing. Like, I don't think that's crazy at all.
What I do have to say about that, though, is that I feel like all the women other than Charlize are overly sexualized, and they're kind of cliche characters. You have, like, the warrior, the fighter, the caregiver, the lover, the mother. Like, they're just so one-dimensional to me. I was actually surprised when I read that she'd come on, because I don't think that...
You're talking about the models?
Yeah, the models.
Yeah.
I don't think that they were...
I have to argue that, Andrew, because if you look at it from a standpoint of who they were at the beginning of the film, they were one-dimensional, as they were only the sexualized females because they're in the brothel.
Right.
That's what they're supposed to be. They're supposed to develop into these new people. This is showing them actually becoming people who they are after they're outside of this. They're reacting to the world. Like, it's kind of a... Like, it shows their character development. It's not creating one-dimensional characters outside of that. It's actually allowing them to develop into two-dimensional characters. So you have to see that development from one to two.
I do understand what you're saying, but I don't think that these women portray women that have been beaten, raped, and in prison their whole life.
I could see where you're going with that, but even the struggle, like, if you allow that, and you, even the struggle of when at one point, I forget which one it was, but she wants to go back because this other life that they're trying to create is hard. So it's like, you're actually thinking of going back to a man who's raping and beating you, which is a theme that women deal with. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in there that I feel like having her on board, you know, probably helped out. It's almost like when you have a police scene on a medical show, like, you have a real cop there to make sure it's legit.
It's like professional consultant.
Right.
I just mean, it's like, when you watch this movie and watching the behind the scenes and thinking about how insane and intense of a shoot this was, the idea of having an award-winning playwright that is, like, on set, it, like, the vagina monologues is so far from Mad Max in my mind. The concept of the two of them together, not that it's, I don't mean funny in, like, a bad way. It's, like, funny in, like, a what a crazy movie kind of a way.
Yeah. I think it's brilliant for them to try and do something, because the vagina monologues, too, I don't know if you guys have ever seen it, but I feel like it gives its point, but it doesn't shove it down your throat.
Sure.
And I feel like that's also why having someone like her on board was good, because I feel like, again, we get what's happening, but it's not like shoved down your throat in a way where you're like turned off by it.
Maybe I wanted a little bit more of that then. I don't know. I had trouble buying their history.
My thing with the girls was this, and I was watching and I was thinking, a couple different times in the movie, I was thinking, okay, The thing we've talked about in previous episodes, this theory that when you're watching something great in the action genre, you're asking yourself the question when you're watching, like, is this good? Is this bad? Is this really good? I can't even tell. I'm just really enjoying it, right? You're like, you don't really know. It's not obvious to you if it's good or bad.
Right.
I bought like models with guns. Rarely do I buy models with guns in movies. They try to do it all the time. Mm-hmm. In action movies, they pull some model, they put a gun in her hand. For whatever reason, I bought it. I liked them as characters. Here's a question for you guys. Was Charlize Theron previously a breeder?
Did they address this in the film?
I don't think so.
I'm pretty sure that's why she wants to get revenge.
I was thinking
it. She escaped,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you... I mean, so she was like a breeder who then becomes like the, you know, general of the army.
Well, I think too,
because she gets kidnapped as a child,
right?
Yeah,
and brought to the city. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
maybe she couldn't have kids.
Yeah, maybe,
you know.
And then yeah, she. I mean, clearly at the beginning, from what I got, and again, just, I got that she, because when they first saw her driving the war vehicle, it wasn't a danger, like she was supposed to be on their side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
You're surprised.
And then she like goes rogue.
She's like the general kind
of. She's the only woman.
Only woman that's, so maybe she for some, but she didn't, like they didn't just be like, hey, we got a cool girl, let's have her in the crew. Like she was there, she was kidnapped, like she wasn't there by choice, maybe, I don't think. Hmm.
Did you guys pick up on an extreme lack of ethnic diversity in people? Were there any black characters in the whole movie?
They're just all white people.
Right.
Well,
I mean, they were painted
Kravitz
white.
Is
lots
like
of people.
White.
I mean, a couple of the girls. You had Zoe Kravitz, darker skin.
I feel like, and there was.
One,
I feel
one
like
of the
all
girls.
The girls were a little diverse. Mm-hmm. And I also, just to go back to that whole model what gun thing, I feel like it went back to that's the way that Amort and Joe wanted them. Like they didn't dress. They didn't choose to dress and look the way that they looked.
Right, true.
They were told that this is what you're wearing. Mm-hmm. This is what you're doing. This is when I'm having sex with you. This is, you know what I mean. Yep. So it's, I don't feel like the whole buying into the way that they looked. I don't think that that was their choice.
It wasn't the look. It was the way they acted.
Yeah. I think something that I was noticing about this movie, and I almost use this as my thesis. This movie is a sort of. It's a crude metaphor for hell. It's like basically the world has descended to the brink of hell because Morton Joe is the devil.
Wow.
He's
mm-hmm.
Satan. His children are all these like either like massive dudes or this deformed little guy with like, you know, they're all these sort of like spawn of Satan type of characters.
The midget baby.
Yeah, these are his angels, obviously. Yeah. I mean, they're the only characters that are the color scheme in the whole movie are wearing white. They're all these beautiful, like they're supposed to be angels that he's you know, defacing.
Right.
And you basically have, you know, like Charlize Theron is like a fallen angel. She's essentially who's looking for like redemption.
I like this theory.
And Tom Hardy is like sort of I guess he's a roamer or something like that, you know, between he's like somewhere between earth and hell because he's obviously had to do a lot of like horrible things to stay alive.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about that as I was watching it and like that's you know, it's like that's what you sort of with those girls when you first see them in the desert. That was the first thing I thought. I was like, "Oh, angels in the desert." I was like, that's what you're putting.
Yeah, they look it.
One of the girls.
It's so funny that I didn't think that at all.
The main girl, the pregnant one,
Rosie.
Yeah, she's like obviously she's a Victoria's Secret angel. She wears the wings. Like that's what she's known for.
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
cast her. You know what I mean? I don't know. That was like the first thing that I thought of. So
right. You know what's interesting about the whole the hell and that thing is. I feel like when Nux, who I can't believe we haven't talked about him yet because it's an hour into the movie and I feel like he was one of the best things about this movie.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the other guys, when they do almost do the deed where they're giving, it's almost like they're on a suicide mission for their higher being.
Right.
What's that?
Is it Valhalla?
Yeah. So I feel like and they also, I believe, I don't know the verbiage exactly, but there's a mention of him getting to some sort of gates.
Yeah.
So I feel like I like that.
Yeah, I thought it was
what you were saying, that thesis.
There's like, I think there's like a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
There's also the parallel to like this movie being made now and how it's relates to socioeconomic, you know, the depression that's going on in our world, both with the environment and everything like that. And, back then it was nuclear warfare that was the scare when they made the first movies, and that was why they made these movies. The post-apocalyptic genre was born out of nuclear bombs. This genre is, I think, born out of climate change and you know, drought. So but anyway, the last thing I was going to say is that with regarding the stunts again, in an interview Charlize Theron said that the most dangerous stunt, the one that freaked everyone out, was the one where Tom Hardy is hanging from the moving car with his head like inches off the ground, and he's just hanging as the car is moving.
Love it.
And that everyone was freaked out. She
Anything
was freaked out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was, you know, she was like, if that was me, I would be so not cool with this. I believe was the quote. So,
Tom Hardy's such a badass.
You know, one more thing real quick about the girls. It's funny because I'm usually that person that watches movies like this and sees the girl where they just have like the hot girl that can't act or something. And it's funny because I didn't think that once in this movie. I didn't think like, look at these bitches that can't act and they're just there. To
I was
be,
on
like,
board with
I
them.
Can't.
Yeah, I agree. Same.
Yeah. So I was totally on board with them.
So, okay, we are going to get, we're running a little short on time. So we are going to get into recasting some of the things we do at the end of the show here. But before we do, I wanted to say to you guys, please, please, please subscribe to us on YouTube. Find us, comment, subscribe, rate on iTunes. It helps us do what we do. It helps us stay high in the ratings for to continue doing this show and other shows like it. We are all on Twitter. So if you want to interact with us personally, we would love to shout back at you and respond to questions, things like that. So yes, please find us online and let's, before, without further ado, let's get into favorite line.
Okay. I'm going to let you guys go first on this one. I'm going to hold mine back.
I'm going to let Steven play mine. Steven?
You ready?
Yeah, yes.
we're ready.
What a lovely day!
I'm so sorry.
What a lovely day!
I love him. I want to go find him and hug him. I think he brought so much to this movie, and his arc and how he started off like wanting to die for this guy, mm-hmm. then coming around to saving the other team, quote unquote. It just, for me, his character was great, so I had to go with something that he said, and I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I like him in X-Men, but this is a total change in his career. This is going to be that movie that changes his career.
Yeah.
He's phenomenal in it. You love him the whole time. You don't want to hate him.
Yeah.
You never do. He's just determined and dedicated to his leader. He's not a bad guy. And then when you finally see that switch, exactly, you see that switch, you're like, oh, good. I wanted to love you this whole movie. And then he sacrifices himself. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, this guy's career, Nicholas Hoult. And we'll talk about it when we talk about recasting in a second. But he's a guy that one of his early roles that I can think of is he's the son in The Weatherman with Nicolas Cage, which is one of my favorite movies.
Right. Yeah.
He then shows up a few years later in the Tom Ford movie, A Single Man, I think, or A Simple Man? Single Man. Mm-hmm. I think it's A Single Man.
I didn't see that one.
And at the time when that movie came out, I didn't put two and two together about The Weatherman. I was like, oh, he looks like a Tom Ford model, some kid who probably had no acting experience and was probably in a campaign, and Tom Ford was like, you're beautiful, I want to put you in this movie. He then shows up in the X-Men movies, mm-hmm. and now he's in this. Talk about a guy whose career has really just sort of like the ins and outs of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so favorite line.
It's your turn.
I think speaking of the climate change line, I'm going to go with the Immortan Joe when he is giving water out at the beginning. And he says, I believe, to the audience, he says, do not become dependent on water or you'll resent its absence.
Yeah.
I might be like a word off on that line. Obviously, I just saw the movie in theaters and I couldn't go back and watch it again. But the reason I think it's so poignant is because as absurd as this movie is, just in everything about it, and is awesome and crazy and the slam bang action thriller quality of it.
Yeah. Travers.
It's the most intelligent line in the movie. I believe the CEO of Nestle went on record last year saying, do not be, you know, water is not a human right, that whole controversy. And it's just interesting that you would have the villain say something like that in this movie with the drought in California right now and climate change and all that. It's a line that really gets you thinking beyond the movie. That was why.
Yeah, totally. It resonated with me when I heard it as well.
Yeah.
So I have two, again, because I just love this movie and Tom Hardy.
You have a hard time making decisions.
I really do. Well, they're so good. Okay. First one is hope is a mistake.
It's a good line.
It's a great line. It's just the whole movie encapsulated into one line. Hope is a mistake. But then, you know, you see what happens in the movie. The second one is right after he comes back. He rides back in the desert. He catches up with him on the motorcycle, and he's like, I've got this plan.
Yeah.
We're going to ride right into the war party, right through the mountains again. We're going to block it off, and we're going to go back to the Citadel and take it over. And she's just like, what? And he goes, look. It'll be a hard day.
Yeah.
It's just it's so, I just laughed. It was just amazing. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah. I thought your favorite line would be, they know we're defenseless.
That's great. I do love that line.
And then the guy with the guitar. So sweet.
Yeah, he's awesome.
All right. So I do really quickly want to talk about the whole of hero and villain rank all time. Again, this is a tough one because you have to decide if you're going to go with Tom Hardy's Mad Max, if you're going to go with the character Mad Max, or if they qualify at all, or Charlize Theron. The first thing I'll say is, in the trope of strong female characters in action movies, that trope, which is very weak to this point, mm-hmm. there hasn't been that many of them. We talked at length about Emily Blunt when we did the Edge of Tomorrow episode. She's one of the coolest ones ever. She's mm-hmm. fantastic. You have Sigourney Weaver in Aliens and Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2, but this is a great character. Like, it's... I know I said earlier that I don't think that she like makes the movie, but in terms of if I was just looking at her part in the movie, if you took all the action away and just her performances and her scenes, she's great. She's a total badass. She looks awesome. She's pretty, but not in a distracting way at all. Mm-hmm. The fake hand, I mean, all that is just... She, in the female pantheon, thus far, she's a top 10 for me.
Yeah.
Tom Hardy's Mad Max is forgettable, in my opinion. It's, I didn't think he did a bad job. It's just, it just, he didn't do much for me.
I mean, he has like a dozen lines in the movie.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I guess Mad Max as a character, for me personally, doesn't even break my top 30. Like, some people like him a lot. It's just not something I have a lot of fondness for.
I got to speak to that, though. You mind?
Yeah, go ahead. Please.
Please.
You say that he doesn't, like, break the top 30 or whatever, and he doesn't say that much, and doesn't really affect it, and he's forgettable. That's kind of the point of the character. Mm-hmm. And that's the really interesting thing about these stories that they tell through the Mad Max movies is you look at this movie, and you look at the world they created and how Max really was only just an added person to that world that changes the story, and then he's gone. Because now they're in control of that place, you have everything going on, but... It wouldn't have happened without Max, but he was never the major player in what was going on with everything. Even looking at Road Warrior, he wasn't like the main person from that story. He's just somebody who drifted in, made his mark, and drifted out. He's always been just the drifter. He's just a road warrior. Yeah. So if you're only remembering Mad Max, then they didn't do a good job in the movie. You're remembering the story and remembering everything that happened, not one character.
So that speaks to the franchise, though, not the character. And this discussion is ranking the character. So I think that's a fair point, though.
Absolutely.
I think it's a very intelligent point.
It's interesting because he's signed on for 3 more sequels, so maybe we will see him emerge as this hero, which
maybe.
I can't wait to see.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe. 3 more, yeah, they announced. Yeah. That's so crazy.
That is crazy.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Yeah.
All right, so what do you guys think on the rankings?
Charlize Theron, top 5.
Female characters.
Female. She's phenomenal. I love it. She's a badass. She's vulnerable. She gets hurt. I mean, she lives, which is also, you know, everyone has the same blood type back then. Let's not even get into that.
Yeah, sure.
I know.
I was watching it. I was like, oh, here's a moment where I'm kind of...
Wait. You missed that.
Oh, did I?
No, you missed that. Because when they're tattooing Max after they catch him, it has his blood type. Type O, universal donor.
Oh,
they were using him as a blood bag.
I missed that.
That's why they tattooed him. Sure.
Okay. I love it. All right.
I totally missed it too. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay. So
I got it, guys. I knew that.
Thanks for stopping me, then, Ben.
Just thought I'd let you make a fool of yourself, Andrew.
At least I'm not sweating this time.
Well,
a little bit. Okay. So she's top 5 for me. Mad Max, top 50, maybe.
Just characters.
Yeah.
As a character, yeah. I mean, I guess that's fine. I'll put him just outside my top 30, or right like 30th, right in there.
Yeah, I agree. I said Charlize Theron top 5, and I didn't even think about Mad Max.
There you go.
It's not in my top 30
top
to top 50 is like, come on.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, that's how I feel.
All right.
What about the villain?
Martin Joe. I mean,
he's good.
He is a good villain. The thing about Warren Joe is, so at the beginning of the movie when they put the harness on him and the way he's breathing, he's very Darth Vader. That's like the thing that comes to mind when you first see him for me. He's iconic to me in his look. And I guess for villains in these type of movies that are memorable, he is pretty memorable.
Yeah.
He does a good enough job. Obviously, this whole movie, that's the whole thing about this movie, this discussion of this movie and these characters. It's very difficult to put it in the same category as, like, Crimson Tide. Like, it's...
Right.
How do you do that? Mm-hmm. Which is what we're trying to do. If you're just going generally, I guess I'll give a Morton Joe a top 20 billing, because I think he's a pretty sweet villain.
Yeah.
But...
Really?
What?
I don't know. I want to hear what she has to say.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I feel... I agree with you. He looked cool, but, like... How are you a villain and you get your face ripped off?
But that's the best part. Like, that's when you
but
know someone's
me,
a good villain.
But to me, he wasn't... I wasn't scared by him.
Yeah.
I wasn't creeped out by him. He didn't... Like, it was more of, they're all coming to get us, and then there's 3 different ways they're coming to get us, and we're escaping. Like, he was kind of creepy, and especially at the end when you see... I mean, I guess creep is a characteristic of a villain.
Right.
But, you know, especially when they capture the one... her name's escaping me. The pregnant girl back again,
right,
and they're trying to take the... Like, that's all creepy and scary,
but
It wasn't like the Joker, or it wasn't sort of... Like, it didn't continuously be like, where's he at? Is he coming? It was more of the whole message. So I kind of put him... Not even in my radar.
Like I said, he's visually iconic to me.
Visually amazing.
He's memorable for me, But he's not great.
Yeah.
So that's top 20, top 25. It's just difficult. It's hard to think of guys.
He's memorable the way he looks, but he's not memorable for me for the way he made me feel.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'll put him in the top 25 because he's got all this water. He's not giving it to all these people. He's got all these women locked up. He cuts open the woman that he cares about the most because he's carrying his son. This dude's a bad dude. He's not a good guy. And then with him getting his face ripped off in the end, some of my favorite villains of all times, their deaths are awesome. Like, when that death happened, I was like, yes!
Right.
You know, along with, Joaquin Phoenix in Gladiator, you've got General Hummel in The Rock.
Right.
Like, there's these villains that when you watch them die, you're just like, yes!
Yeah, right.
And I had that moment with him, and I think that's a testament to him being a great villain. So I put him in the top, you know what, 20. I'm gonna do 20.
All right, fair enough.
I'm going to, in context of the conversation, I'm going to drop him outside my top 30.
Oh, great.
You just de-sold me.
Yeah.
let's get into recasting. Everyone's favorite part. And for this exercise, guys, you know, we always say with Fist Pump and Recast, we want to know yours as well. So please comment on YouTube if you have a set of actors you think would be better than our recasts. Just type them up and send them in the comments or tweet at us. Either way, we'll give our Twitter handles at the end. Recasting the three characters of Tom Hardy, Charlize Theron, and Nicholas Holt. Go ahead, Steph.
For Charlize Theron, I could recast Scarlett Johansson.
Okay.
For Nicholas Holt, I would recast Jake Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal now?
Yeah.
As Nicholas Holt?
Did you see Nightcrawler?
I get what you're saying about Nightcrawler, but I...
He's not young or innocent enough. He's not, like, sweet enough.
Yeah.
He's not...
But...
Shaved head Jake Gyllenhaal would just look weird.
But that's what it is. Have you not seen the previews for his new boxing movie?
Yeah.
Southpaw.
He looked kind of... Anyway, and I know you both disagree with this one, but I definitely think he could pull it off. For Tom Hardy, Jason Statham.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, I think he could pull it off. Not for a second.
Who do you got that's
ridiculous.
Better?
Like, it's too ridiculous.
No, who do you got that's better?
Hey, you got one more, and then I will tell
no,
you.
No, I just gave you my three.
Oh, she did. I'm sorry. Yeah. Say what you were saying earlier, I love when you guys comment and on YouTube about your recasting. It is so fun to read what you guys have to say. I always look forward to commenting back. Mine are Paul Dano for Nicholas Holt.
That's pretty good.
He's kind of Weasley. He's kind of creepy. He's a phenomenal actor as well.
Sure.
So I think he could fill almost any role. Emily Blunt.
Yeah.
As Charlize Theron.
That's so cliche. She's in everything.
She is. But you know what? She's 2 inches shorter than Charlize. She's a few years younger than her. She's a badass.
Yeah.
I could totally see her playing this role. And I think she would do a shit head.
I couldn't see that.
Emily Blunt, you're saying?
Yeah, I don't think I could see her playing this role.
I think she's too pretty and frail.
I was going to say she's too frail.
She's pretty and frail. Like,
that's
Edge of Tomorrow, she's like so small looking.
She's very fragile.
Well, she's a complete
badass.
She's
total badass.
She's the full
she's
metal bitch.
Yeah. Kind of like a
she's amazing.
Flower.
Okay, all right, that's fine. And you know,
you're wrong, Edge.
You are not.
Your
opinion is wrong.
No, I'm just
you know, and I'm going to give a little shout out to Steven here. He said Natalie Portman. I can almost hop on board with that as well.
I thought about it.
I like
shaved head.
Yeah, she's good. She's good to be for Vendetta. The last one. And it's interesting because Tom Hardy was actually considered for the role of him in the new Terminator movie is Jai Courtney.
Oh, I'm not familiar with Jai Courtney.
You know who he is if you saw him. He's the guy in the new Terminator. He's been in other action movies. He looks a lot like Tom Hardy.
Okay.
He's in the Die Hard, I think, the most recent Die Hard.
Oh, that guy.
As Bruce Willis'
son.
Yeah,
I know you're talking about.
They have a very similar look, demeanor, body
He was in
type.
Jack Reacher as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I think he'd be a great replacement.
You know, real quick, but you know, I don't know that we mentioned it earlier, so make sure we touch on it, that at one point Heath Ledger was also supposed to be, which I think he would have, of course, done great.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see what you got making fun of mine, Jason Statham. Jason Statham makes any movie a good action movie.
So I want Scarlett Johansson as well. I think that's a really, really good choice. After Lucy,
almost as good as Emily Blunt.
After Lucy, like, I think shaved head ScarJo, like, I think she would just...
ScarJo.
I just said that.
Out loud.
Hashtag ScarJo.
I think she'd be really, really good. I said Sam Worthington for Tom Hardy.
Him and Eric Bana were both rumored to be the role, and they both denied that they were ever involved.
I mean, Worthington is... It almost feels cheap to say it, just because he looks and feels so much like that character. Like, that's like what he's done with his career almost to this point.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I don't think he's burly enough.
His role in Terminator Salvation is essentially just like...
Right.
He would just be the same. He would act in sort of a similar way. And then I went with Anton Yelchin.
I like him.
Little skinny.
Okay. Definitely done that.
Little skinny kid.
Fair enough.
The one thing we haven't seen out of him is we haven't seen that intensity that you see out of this guy. But then again, this guy is sort of fake intensity because he's just sort of pretending.
Yeah. He's a little boy.
Yeah. So Anton Yelchin, I think he'd have to like put a little size on.
Yeah.
A little bit. But I think he could do it. He looks innocent enough. So yeah, that's my request.
Okay. Sweet.
Jeremy Renner was pulling for this role.
Yeah, he was campaigning for it. I saw that.
What would you have thought with him in that role?
I think Renner could have probably done it.
Yeah, the more stuff I see with him, the more I like him.
Yeah, I loved him in The Town. I think he could have done it. I'm glad that he wasn't in it.
Well, the one last thing I was going to mention that I forgot to talk about, really different than most of the action movies that we're used to seeing, the first hand-to-hand combat in this movie doesn't happen for 90 minutes.
Well, isn't there a hand-to-hand combat in the first 2 minutes when he's running away?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's him pushing people, but in terms
pushing,
of like
kicking. Yeah, he punches a few people.
I don't know about that, because I was like, I noticed the distinct difference when he's standing on the tanker and he's fighting with the guys and he's kicking and punching and ducking and like, mm-hmm. you know, hand to hand, like you see in these movies that we're used to seeing all the time. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, we've seen a bunch of cars.
It wasn't as much of a fight as it was a struggle when he was trying to get away. That's when you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
When he was in the water and he was like fighting them off as much as a fight.
Yeah, because we're used to these movies, people standing in place and fighting.
Instead of him like taking out all eight of them, he was trying to get away from them. Okay,
I
understand that.
I see your point.
But anyway, that's the final thought of the day.
Yeah.
Nice.
This was a long show, but we had a lot to say.
Very passionate.
It was
about
a good one.
Very good movie.
This was a good one. I can't wait for the next three installments. So the last thing to do before we sign off, we'll be quick about this, is we have to establish which category this fits into. Mm-hmm. And the three categories that we deal with every week are Totally Ridiculous, that is Fall Off a Cliff of Absurdity, Face Off comes to mind, mm-hmm. Totally Legitimate, which is like sort of like Die Hard, The Fugitive, movies that are like very bankable and could have been nominated for awards, and Ridiculously Legitimate, which is the hybrid category. It seems like most of our movies fit into that category because that's why we choose them, which is the perfect combo of the two. So this is a really tough one to categorize. I'm gonna let you guys go first.
Totally Legitimate.
Big surprise from the guy who thinks it's the greatest action movie of all time.
Look, man, they did 90% of the stunts on their own. Steven saved my butt back there talking about his universal blood type.
Like, yeah.
They put in the work to make this movie believable.
Yeah,
it's
awesome.
Totally Legitimate.
I'm going to agree.
Yes!
I think it might be the one thing we agreed on all day, but I kind of am on board. No, we did. We totally did. We agreed on a lot. I kind of...
Yeah.
It's like borderline Ridiculously Legitimate, but it's teetering towards Totally for me.
It's so hard because I want to say...
Say it.
It's Totally Ridiculous.
What? Get out.
What?
Get out. We need a new lead host, guys. If you sign up on Twitter, YouTube, iTunes, we are hiring a new host.
It's Totally Ridiculous. And this is a tough one because it's not in the middle category. It's really not. The middle category is reserved for movies that are a hybrid. This is way in one direction or way in the other, depending on how you want to perceive the movie. I think that you could easily make the argument that it's totally legitimate because it's beautiful. It's a masterpiece visually.
Right.
It has all of the things that you guys are categorizing it for correctly. I agree with. But I think that the movie is so absurd. It's such like an absurd. It's such an absurd movie. It's just a giant action sequence for 2 hours. You got to remember, we only do movies on the show that qualify as being like, you're like above the norm if you're in the categories. So so it being ridiculous doesn't make it a bad movie. Like, to me, Face Off is an awesome movie. It's a great movie. I love Face Off to death. It's just that it's totally absurd to watch. This movie is totally absurd to watch. It's beautiful. It's executed extremely well. But it doesn't have dialogue to me that like makes it memorable. Like the characters are like I said, mostly throwaway. It's just a bunch of action scenes that are sweet to watch.
I think the thing that keeps it out of that category for me is that little bit of plot that's there. Mm. I mean, they're chasing them for this fuel that they need, which fuel and runs the world pretty much.
Yep.
There's drought, like the things that keep it in sense of what it's really like. I get that it's huge, big action scene. It's a big car chase, but they're chasing for this. I forget exactly. Is it the petroleum? No, they call it something else. They don't call it gas, but
they're
call
chasing
it oil.
They have a fuel.
Like she's supposed to. Like they're fighting, and she's supposed to be able to get away from this and have the rocks come down and be safe because she delivers this thing that everyone needs.
It's just
like,
fuel. It's just straight up.
It was just fuel. I thought they called it something in the movie, but I feel like that's what keeps it.
Yeah.
Legitimate.
Just my opinion, guys.
Yeah. It is. Not always right. It's all right, man. Don't worry.
All right. Well, that's going to pretty much wrap it up for Action Movie Anatomy, Mad Max Fury Road. That was a really, really awesome, engaging, long conversation. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did because I had a great time. If you want to follow me or my co-hosts here on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, etc., here's where you can find us.
You guys can find me on all the social media platforms at IAMSTEFZ.
At Andrew Guy, that's G-H-A-I.
And once again, guys, please rate, subscribe, follow on iTunes, YouTube, whatnot. I am Ben Bateman, Ben Bateman Media on Twitter, Instagram, and occasionally Periscope. We will see you next week.
Thank you so much, Steph.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.